A couple of evenings back, I visited the talismanic frontman of James in his dressing room before a show. The band's new album, Living in Extraordinary Times, is out in August, and management sent me a copy about 10 days ago in order to prepare for meeting up. So I'd geared my questions and my notes around it, the themes it contains, the mechanics of its making. But one of the things I've learned in conducting over 400 interviews for The Mouth magazine in the last 6 years is that very occasionally that meticulous preparation and route planning of questions counts for nothing. The artist wants to talk, not necessarily, in quotation marks, just be interviewed. So here, as the very special 250th edition of The Mouthcast, is an unfolding conversation with Tim Booth.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
I'm not dreaming about you tonight. All my mind can't let go. All my mind can't control. I'm not thinking about you tonight. Counting the cost of what I have lost, stringing pearls I can't take back, twisted in knots on the judo mat. Oh, my mind can't control. Across your heart, just passing through, took my words and made them true. How recklessly I love, not so impressed. How I'm invested, I'm broken, heading south, destitute and
yeah.
Did you see the Scorsese documentary about George Harrison?
Mm-hmm.
We watched it the other night, and there was this great bit where, when Lennon was killed, Olivia says that George's reaction was really upset that Lennon didn't leave his body in the manner that he would choose, that he left his body in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that George's life, he felt, was training to leave his body in mm-hmm. the manner of his own choosing. I thought mm-hmm. that was really, really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. The whole point of philosophy is to learn how to prepare for death.
Mm.
I think that was a Plato quote from Aristotle.
I haven't worked out what's next afterwards. I haven't quite found...
You mean after you die?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's there?
Well, you come back again.
Okay.
My experience, I've died a number of times, and right. I remember quite a few. And I can get back to them too, interestingly enough.
Hmm.
It's not really possible to put it into words. It's quite fascinating. It's like, we're here, and then you can go up and up into different levels, and then to a total singularity, which is essentially... give it a name, the religions call it God or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you can come back all the way back down again through different levels back to here again. And the weird joke is that they're all as important as each other, because we think that's more important than this, and it's not. They're all experiences of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a recent thing I got, which was really fascinating for me. To discover that they were all the same. Because all my life I've wanted to get to God, wanted right. to get to a singularity. I've always been yearning for it. And then when I got to that place, I found that actually that place as much wants to come down here. God is that,
right,
God,
right.
God, when I did get to that place, God was lonely because there's only one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And God was also going, if I'm God, who made me? Which I thought was another really interesting question for God to be asking. God's a terrible word to say, but the singularity was lonely because there was only one thing, and the singularity was going, what created me? Because it didn't know.
Mm.
Which I thought was like, oh, that's really interesting. Now we're really fucked.
I suppose for us, we know... I suppose the body's like a car, that the
yeah.
spirit or soul or, you know, whatever word is applicable drives around in, and it's our animal parents that created that car. And I always think the question is not where do we come from, but why are we here? You know, I'm not sure.
Have you ever met different versions of yourself where you meet someone who's really quite like you, but they're just like another slice off a lemon?
I see people who can have no possible family connection, and I can see that they must have a family connection at some point in the past. They're absolutely from the same small area of the gene pool or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that fascinating, that that's spread out, just the biology of that, I suppose. No, I've never met another me.
I met another me, and he's really close to being me, but had made slightly different choices. And I think you know, the singularity wants to experience stories. I mean, it does seem to be a lot about stories too. I like Sapiens, that book, for that.
Oh, yeah.
The thing that differentiates man from everything else is we are storytellers.
Because
we are. We are storytellers. This is a story. And we're all making it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all, you know, end up in these stories. You know, I've done years in meditation. I was really forced into it to some degree because I had a liver disease that was really bad from about the age of 11 to 21, and it wasn't diagnosed, and so I was always yellow and jaundiced and sick, and I ended up in hospital stopping breathing at 21, and they had no cure. Western medicine said it's as if you've had hepatitis C, and there's nothing we can do for you. It wasn't hepatitis C, but they said it's like that. And I discharged myself from hospital, and I threw myself into you know, woo-woo medicine, you know, all the kind of complementary medicine, which in 1981 was seen as fringe and wacko.
Yeah.
Now it's a little bit more acceptable. And I tried everything, and the illness was the motivator to some degree to send me looking for things, looking for answers. I was miserable with life because I'd had liver disease for so long. It's a really horrible thing to have. You have a whole psyche that goes with it, mm-hmm. a jaundiced view. And meditation, me and Jimmy really got into, partly for me and Jimmy, but also to rescue our guitar player who was smoking dope, but he couldn't smoke dope. It just turned him. It made him go a bit crazy. He ended up in the psychiatric hospital. Mm. So we thought if we could get him to an alternative high, we could get him off the dope. And we loved him. Lovely, beautiful man. He was called Paul. So we dragged him into this meditation group. Unfortunately, he left after about 8 weeks. We stayed.
Right.
And we ended up having some very wild experiences and meditating, you know, all my life, really. And then I found the dance work with Gabrielle, which was a way of going into trance states through dancing. And my wife's a shaman. She's an amazing healer, and people fly around the world to come and work with her. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in that world. That's my world outside James. I teach that work. I also teach the movement system to get people into trance states. I sometimes teach meditation. I'm a trained therapist. So all that, that's a side that I never discuss, really, or doesn't really get brought up in James. But
Funnily enough, I was going to ask you about it, because obviously to a lot of people you are Tim Booth from James, but I've always had the sense that you've never allowed that to define you, that you are Tim Booth and James is just one area of your life, and there is all of this other stuff. There was acting for a while, there's dance, and these alternative therapies and healing processes that you're talking about. So you are removed from the rock and roll artifice, which is it's just there, isn't it? Whether you're a 100% open artist and all of that, rock and roll is still there somehow, isn't it?
Yes. I think what you're talking about, from my point of view, is projection. You know, it's like, if you're known for being a singer in a band, everybody you meet who you don't know, so you're coming to them going, who's this? They have some idea of who they think you are.
Yeah.
And so you're being projected upon, which is a weird thing to happen. And it can be nice, because sometimes people project very lovely things onto you, especially when you've written songs that touch people. Mm. But it's still a bit unreal, and it can lead you into an unreal landscape if you're not careful.
Yeah.
I was talking to a really close friend of mine who knows really famous people, you know, and she was describing how they walk into a restaurant and everyone in the restaurant pretends they haven't seen them. Mm-hmm. But everyone in the restaurant is really trying to eavesdrop to hear what on earth they're doing or to watch them without being seen to be watching them. Mm. And that's that person's reality, that they walk into a room and all these people are pretending not to witness them, but actually all they want to do is know what the hell they're talking about and what's going on in their life. It's no life. Mm. It's a hall of mirrors. And it can obviously lead to narcissism at the very least, but insanity, really. It's not really the story you want to get trapped in.
It's very interesting that I didn't realise it was the illness that had led you to those things. I thought that it was perhaps a reaction to, for want of a better word, celebrity, notoriety, fame.
No, I was curious. I don't know if it was fully due to the illness, but I'd always been looking for purpose and what the hell is this life about? We're born, we come from somewhere, we're born, we live this life, we die, we go somewhere. And we don't know the two bookends. We don't know what goes on beyond the bookends. Mm. And as a kid, I was always like, well, we have to know. That's obviously the main reason for being here. There must be a reason, or is there a reason why we don't know? Who's stopping us from knowing? By about 22 or 23, I gave myself a year to find proof of the existence of some meaning in life, or I was going to go.
When you say go,
I was going to allow myself to die. It wouldn't take much. I was pretty sick at the time. Mm. And all it meant was just drinking and smoking and stuff like that, because my liver was so bad. I was so jaundiced and yellow that it wouldn't take too much. And I did find my answers in that year. After about 10 months, I found what I was looking for, which was great.
In the nick of time.
I mean, it wasn't right to the day, but it was about 10 months. And then for me, it's been about just following that stuff. It's been always been really fascinating to me and really important to me.
So where does James correlate with that, if you like? Because obviously, like we say, there are different areas of your life, but there must be a connection. You can see on stage that you are moved by what you're doing, you're completely in the moment.
Gosh, I don't see these things as separate. I guess the word spirituality, I hate the word spirituality because it immediately assumes a superiority. And for me, it's about technologies. I use dance as a technology to get into altered states, music to get into altered states, to other perspectives. So you aren't stuck in the one perspective, because we naturally, as humans, gravitate to quite a small-minded being if we're not careful, if we're not challenging ourselves, working on ourselves, being challenged by life, being stretched. That's when the really amazing stuff comes out of us. Often when people have been ill, or have been in some huge accident or have a cancer diagnosis, that's when people often decide to start living, ironically enough. And for me, it's better to meet it head on and find the technologies that can get you to that realization, so you don't need those disasters to happen, if you can. And that mean, and you know, I love doing James. James is passionate, wild, messy, clumsy, chaotic. You know, they're writing a set list tonight. So Jim and Saul are writing a set list tonight, and I'll have to go out and sing it, and there'll be a song on it. There's at least one song in it that I have no idea what the words are. So I'll probably have to either print them out or make them up. And so we love random factors because it stops us becoming predictable and old like most bands get. You know, most bands with the same sets every night, computerized lighting doing the same thing every night. It's boring. It's like it's not living. It's not breathing. I want the gig in Scunthorpe to be totally different to the gig in Hull. Yeah. You know, and everyone to have totally different experiences. It's about being in the moment. So James is about being in the moment. They've done studies of wholehearted people, was the study this woman has done. They've done a study on wholehearted people, and all wholehearted people in the study had some creativity. They had something that they did that was their creativity.
Wholehearted meaning?
It was kind of on a happiness index of, yeah. It was when the therapists, because for years when therapists were studying people, they always studied people who were ill, people who were mentally ill, schizophrenic, autism, and then somebody went, I think it's Maslow was the first guy, he went, why aren't we studying when people seem really healthy and what makes them healthy, what makes them happy, what makes them love life and get the most out of life? He had a phrase called about peak experiences. People who get lots of peak experiences where they just feel absolutely present and so happy to be alive. And how many of those do you get in a week or in a day? And they started to look at what they called wholeheartedness, people who live a wholehearted life. And I wish I could remember her name, the woman's work. She wrote a great book on vulnerability. It's her definition. She was a statistician, basically, who was interviewing people who they decided that were on high on the happiness index to try and work out how they did it. And creativity was absolutely a prerequisite of anybody who had any kind of real sense of, like, I love life.
That in itself is quite interesting, because creativity often goes hand in hand with depression, I think.
That's a really good point.
Have you ever struggled in that way?
No, not really. Not depression. And I wouldn't want to say I've struggled with that, because I've seen people who have struggled with that. I mean, I've been very down in periods, but no, I wouldn't say it's like a magnet, like I've seen for some people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great way to describe it. Magnet.
Yeah,
I've seen that as well. Yeah,
there's some amazing new things, though. You know, for PTSD and depression, and you know, all the psychedelic research that's coming through, where the FDA in America have got, the FDA is the Federal Drug Administration Bureau, I think that's it, in America, and they've got 750,000 vets from Afghanistan and Iraq with PTSD. And a few years ago, they allowed them to do therapy with MDMA. And of the 24 soldiers, 23 of them were cured of PTSD a year later. And they've now started the first legal training of therapy with MDMA and mushrooms in Berkeley University. And it's happening in England as well. You may have read about it. And New Scientist has really got behind it, the science magazine, because they're seeing that these things are really working for people. Ketamine, you know, all these things that people consider recreational party drugs and have been banned, they have a real therapeutic use. They're technologies, they're tools. And I know many people, doctors, nurses, who are training illegally to use that work because they see that it's transforming people's lives, especially with depression, with schizophrenia, people who are facing death and want to know how to face death. And it's one-on-one with a therapist, 8 hours off your tits. And it's brilliant work. And I come from a background of no drugs, no alcohol, because I came from a meditation background, and they always used to sneer at people who took shortcuts to go to altered states. And it's only in the last few years where I've seen that that's, you know, there's a whole shamanic tradition that's been going on for thousands of years of plant medicine, where people have been doing these things, and it's totally valid. But so long as you have some foundation to build on, some practice to ground it, otherwise it does just become a recreational game.
Yeah.
You know, another piece of consumerism. Well, to go back to your point about creativity,
yeah,
it can mean knitting. You know,
yes.
It can mean,
yeah,
I mean, having something that you really passionately love that becomes an obsession, almost a hobbyist obsession.
Mm.
We're not talking about art, a great artist, or being a great artist. We're talking about something you love doing that has a creative aspect to it. That's what we're talking about. So when you linked it to depression, yes, a lot of the great artists have often had such wounds that they have, their lives have seemed pretty miserable. You know, when we used to go and dance with Gabrielle, and Gabrielle was the woman who founded the work that I teach, and people used to come and tell these stories about how they, you know, nearly died of cancer at this age, and they were abused by their parents, and she would just look at them and say, well, I'll be expecting great art from you then. And that was it. It was like, whew, no pity, no victim, no room for the victim, just I'll be expecting great art from you.
As in, the energy is there, the material is there.
Let's see if you
get on with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see what comes. You mentioned veterans, and I did want to ask you actually about, I think we at least have to speak a little bit about Living in Extraordinary Times, the record. The song Hank, actually, in a way, thematically linked back to Hey Ma, for the first time in a while, you were talking very specifically about things, political, global, social, things that were going on. And the line, this president is a tool.
A dangerous tool.
Double meaning, obviously, because dickhead or an instrument for darker forces.
Mm-hmm.
You live in America, and I wondered how Donald Trump impacts on a daily basis on life, whether the sense of tolerance that's around is dissipating, whether anxiety is raising, because that's what it looks like he should be causing to reasonable-minded people, but I don't know. Perhaps that's not what you're seeing. Perhaps people absolutely love it.
No, I live in California.
Right.
And the two coasts of America, which are the most populated areas, but they only get a tiny proportion of the vote proportional to the people. So that's called the Electoral College, which is really a rip-off to allow basically the Republicans to rule. Otherwise, America would be quite a liberal-leaning country if it was done vote per person. But it's not done like that.
It's similar here, no proportional.
It's even worse, though, because, say, I think each, like for the Senate, I think Kentucky get two candidates, California gets two candidates. California is, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of times bigger than Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So it's even more ridiculous. And they have gerrymandering, which we did get rid of in the 70s, which looks like the Supreme Court will throw out, actually, which is good. I mean, there's so many ways they've rigged the vote in America. Very openly and historically, it's all laid out very clearly in, like, Netflix documentary, The 13th, if you watch that documentary. Yep. That's an amazing documentary. Yes, Donald Trump is terrifying, but you can't let him rule your life.
No.
Like, I had, at first, nearly every song had so much of Donald Trump in, and then I decided to focus it onto one or two songs. And so there's a couple of songs now which have got a lot of Donald Trump in, and that's one of them. but also, you know, every day I open the newspaper going, now surely he's been impeached. Today it started. Mm. Today it started. Hank is partly about the impotence of our biggest weapon, are the comedians, Colbert. So that second verse is, our weapon is a stand-up, a jester prancing like a fool. Ingest, digest the monster. That's the only way I can take Trump, is through the comedians. Mm. Is because otherwise you get too depressed. But the good thing about Trump is he's exposed and activated a lot of people. He's exposed a lot of racism and misogyny and all the corruption. It's right out there for everyone to see now. And a load of people are getting very active and angry. Black Lives Matter, Women's March, most importantly, probably both those two, of anything. And there's going to be a big kickback.
And I suppose the same could be said over here. Brexit has done the same. That's exposed a lot of the intolerances that were under the surface now for a little more overt, aren't they?
Yeah.
The things going on, like in Ireland, the repeal the 8th. I know it's ERA, so it's not part of the United Kingdom, but it's on our doorstep, and it's unbelievable to be reminded that that stuff's going on in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all thought it was all swinging our way, didn't we?
Yeah,
and now,
absolutely.
I mean, I don't think it's going to stop. I just think these things have to swing back at certain points and then swing forward again. Mm. So I'm not, you know, I've got some friends who I talk to, and I'll talk about the political situation, and they'll depress the hell out of me. And I've got other friends with exactly the same information, and somehow you leave the conversation feeling incredibly uplifted and positive. Take your pick. In the end, you have to choose what you want to feed your psyche with. Do you want to be a happy person and try and make change? Or do you want to be a depressed person and be angry and bitter and try and make change? Mm. And you've got to somehow find a way of maintaining your own personal power and your own personal life, and trying to be as active as you possibly can to help try and change.
I mean, the band has always been socially conscious. There have been various concerts over the years for causes and contributions to things. I think when the Record Store Day releases quite recently, actually, was an old Greenpeace concert. So in that sense, there is a collective statement by the band that there is a specific side of the fence that the band is on as a whole. Between yourselves, do you talk about this stuff? And
oh yeah,
you know, wildly, vastly different opinions. And
not wildly. I mean, Andy's on the streets. You know, he'll go out on the streets. He's very active politically. Mm. And probably the only person who's more central is Dave, to some degree. But everyone is pretty active and vocal in James. You know, and I mean, you know, it's that's as simple as that, really.
So I've been listening to the new album for about a week. I've sent it about a week ago, and I really, really like it. There's something really, really immediate about it. The band sound absolutely fresh, focused, really sure-footed. It really is a golden era for James.
Yeah, we can't stop writing too. I mean, we're having a great time.
It's a rich scene.
Rich scene. And Charlie Andrews and Benny Giles, who produced this record, were real kindred spirits, and they really helped us find more rhythmical. You know, we've been getting so excited by rhythms, really, and they helped us on this record a lot. Benny a lot, Charlie a lot. They're both drummers. And, you know, we know what we've made. and we're very, very happy with what we're doing at the moment. It's fantastic. I don't know quite how to sum up the album, but I guess, I mean, have you seen the cover of the album?
Yeah, the grenade, the flowers.
With flowers. I mean, it trumps the grenade and out of it comes flowers. And it's like, or you know, Brexit's whatever you want. It's again, it's this theme of out of things that look appalling can come the most amazing magic. And having faith in that, really, and trust in that, and seeing it, and living extraordinary times isn't really just about the negative. It definitely is. Had some amazing things happen in the last few years in my life that have ended up in some of these songs.
2 months to go, I think, until it's released.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Tim, once again, thank you for talking to me, but particularly thank you for being the very special guest on the 250th edition of the Mouthcast. Tim Booth, thank you.
Thanks.
www.themouthmagazine.com